Hey,
wait, I got a nut. Put that peanut over there. She's a dog. She's banging her finger.
Yes, I would. Senate Hess, please come to order to let the record show. Senator Fisher, Senator DeBreeze, myself present. Senator Sturgeon Lewski, note when she comes in, Senator Joseph is excused today. Before we go into the report on the Cleary case, I'd like to bring the committee up to date on what's happened with Senate Bill 45 and Senate Bill 63. If you take a half moment while we're waiting for Senator Sturzelewski, you could look at a letter accompanying. For those of you in the room on Senate Bill 45 and Senate Bill 63, I know we have a number of people here for answering questions or to testify if needed. Is there anyone that's against these two bills? Then it's my intention to move them out with their amendments and with their letters. We've had a public hearing on this previously.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'll move for committee substitute Senate Bill number 45 with individual recommendations.
Is there objection?
No.
On Senate Bill 63? We left Senate Bill 63 intact with a letter of prioritization. I understand, however, that there are some questions concerning one of the figures in there. I believe it's on the Cordova Community Hospital. We will note with the Finance Committee on the 14 that is only if the 1 million stays in for in the governor's budget.
As long as they're aware of that.
Is any other comment on that? Then we will not open public hearing on that either. We're looking at the letter. You've seen that, haven't you? Then the chair would accept a motion on Senate Bill 63. I think the letter is merely a formality and will not need to be adopted other than to make everyone aware that it's going with it.
Right.
What is your pleasure? Shall we keep the bill or shall we move it on?
Chair, I just have a question.
Yes.
Appropriate at this time. I thought possibly the rating would be shovel ready versus planning. And I see some planning. Maybe I'm reading some. For example, Kodiak Island, Norton Sound, they're not in any, they're all planning dollars.
That's noted in there.
Okay, but are these the priorities?
They're not listed in accordance to priority. They're listed in accordance to information that we've gotten in the proposed amendments as they were listed with us.
Okay, then maybe the misconception I have is that proposed amendments prioritize right health, education, and social service. Maybe that doesn't mean to be the word prioritize. Maybe shouldn't be there if there's no particular prioritizing order. Because if you read it that way, I may be reading it wrong. You go 1 through 7.
We felt that these were all pretty equal in priority, other than the fact that some were ready to go to some.
Okay, I guess, Madam Chair, if I just might continue, my concern is what's number 7 is ready to go for construction, whereas 5 and 6 are just planning rights. And I thought that speed ready was the criteria that we were setting as a committee. Same thing as number 3 is planning and design and not ready.
Yeah. There are 3 criteria, if you notice, listed in that paragraph. In fact, there are 4 or 5. 5 criteria. I'll give you let's just recess for another minute while people read.
Individual recommendations.
Is there objection? Okay, thank you. That'll give you a chance to relook at that before we're through the day. Today we have a report from the commissioner concerning the Cleary account. Commissioner Dell, if you would please, and if you need or want anyone with you, just bring them up.
Hey, Madam Chairman. I'm Roger Endell, Commissioner of the Department of Corrections, and I thought I would
do a fairly brief but I hope a thorough review of the Cleary order. The Cleary case, as you may know, is a class action suit that has been ongoing for some 3 years, a case which this administration inherited, which really is a class action suit brought by the inmates of the state of Alaska against the state, alleging, in simplified terms, that our correctional system was unconstitutional, especially in those areas of programming, quantity and quality, and the bed space issue, that is, the system was overcrowded. I should tell you that the order issued by the court a little more than a week ago may not be acceptable to the state, and that the attorneys are evaluating the order and the memorandum of decision now, and within a week should be advising us as to the likelihood of an appeal. So we hope that within the next few days we'll have a better feeling for that. The judge issued a 110-page memorandum of decision and a 9-page order. And I thought I'd just run down through these fairly quickly to review what's in the order. And then if you would like further explanation, certainly we could explore those a little further. So first, the court tentatively set presumptive population caps for each institution and the statewide system. Now, that's a little different than our commutation plan that we had in place signed by the governor some year or so ago, since each institution would now have a cap, not just the statewide system. So any time an institution exceeded that capacity, we'd be in a position of either having to move inmates to spaces that were open or potentially release offenders. We have to take account right away to certify the number of beds that are available within the system now. The numbers that were in the judge's order are 8 to 9 months out of date, and in fact we have increased the number of beds dramatically. Secondly, we're to prepare a study regarding the impact of Alaska's presumptive sentencing scheme on the prisoner population projections for the next 3 years, and we're to have that within 120 days. Now, it's very unlikely that we'll be able to comply with that in a 120-day period. I'm not sure that anyone could do a responsible study in that brief time. But it is clear that the court intends for us to evaluate the impact of presumptive sentencing. Third, then, following the impact study and the end of the current legislative session, the Department of Corrections is to present evidence to the court demonstrating how we realistically intend to meet the prisoner population pressures during the next 3 years. At the same time, we're to tell the court, present to the court a timetable for closing Third Avenue and Ridgeview institutions in Anchorage. He wants us to explain to him the use of dorms for housing inmates in primarily Juneau and Fairbanks institutions. He wants us to tell him about the future use of community residential centers or halfway houses. He wants us to give him a plan for increased work and rehabilitation furloughs, and he also wants us to tell him about the future use of executive clemency as a release mechanism when the system is overcrowded. The fourth major area, he wants a report on the number of additional positions funded for the next fiscal year, specifically including positions for rehabilitation programs and health care services, along with a plan to adequately staff new or expanded facilities. Now, several of these, you'll notice that right after the session, we've got to go report all kinds of things. Fifth major area, he has prohibited housing inmates in non-residential and or administrative spaces and said that we can house only one prisoner per cell in segregation cells or in cells used specifically for segregation. Another item, he wants a report to the court regarding the level of funding received from the legislature for additional positions in medical, health care, and dental areas, including medical records and transportation units, and a report, and he wants us to report what we will do if we do not receive the funding. Within 30 days, we're to have these reports to him. We're also to develop regulations that require that only medical personnel may issue medications to inmates. A seventh issue is in search and seizure, and within 30 days he wants us to develop new regulations regarding visual and intrusive body cavity searches. This is one that we particularly have some problems with. We don't have many people that we do intrusive body cavity searches on, and we do it whenever we do it. It's done with medical personnel. But the implication here is the court would like, evidently, to set a higher standard. We don't agree with that. In the area of staffing, at a hearing after the legislative session, we're to advise the court regarding the number of staff positions funded during the session and the number that are unfilled or unfunded, and the manner in which we intend to meet in the increased prisoner populations in new and expanded institutions. In the area of training, within 30 days, we're to submit to the court regulations regarding the retraining of disciplined or suspended staff. In the area of programming, which was one of the major aspects, I really consider the case to have two major aspects, programming being one, overcrowding the other. Within 120 days, we're to develop and implement a rehabilitation program evaluation study, including the study of recidivism. Again, recidivism studies, by their very nature, are longitudinal. They take a great deal of time. Completing this sort of study in 120 days is really not possible. He wanted us to increase programming efforts for women at the Fairbanks Institution, post-secondary education at Ketchikan, increase programs at Third Avenue, and address how we're going to handle the increasing populations at Cook Inlet pretrial facility, all within 30 days. That is, our report is to be done then. He wants us to discontinue the testing of inmates for post-secondary education courses or any minimal requirements. We had previously set an Iowa test of basic skills, which an inmate must score at least the ninth grade level. We had minimal requirements, and he's saying we can't do that anymore. But he did urge us to continue to screen inmates after admission to our institutions regarding rehabilitation needs, but the instruments must be validated and normed for our populations. Especially, he was cognizant of the need for native inmates to have tests that were fair to them. He concluded that prisoners have the right to rehabilitation under our Constitution and statutes, but no right to be rehabilitated is guaranteed by either. In other words, they have a right to reasonable access to rehabilitation programs. He wants us to change our furlough regulations. In fact, one of them had already been changed. The other, he said, was our regulation was more restrictive than the statute. That had to do with the furlough statutes. Statutes place no time period on inmates. In our regulations, we had said that inmates for certain kinds of furloughs had to be within 6 months of their release date. He's saying that that's more restrictive than the statute. That has to come off. I assume that we can set a behavioral standard, but probably not a time standard. He did approve and say that it was all right for us to test our test procedure in regard to urinalysis testing, except that we must be sure to preserve the samples of positive tests for a period so that inmates can then do their own testing to see if they agree with us, in other words. And finally, he had talked about attorney's fees, and this is the paragraph that the press reported widely as saying that because of the number of changes, the significance of changes that corrections has made over the last 2 to 3 years, that in his view, the inmates were the winners in the case, so to speak. Now, that has more to do with the attorney's fees and so on than it does anything else. As far as we're concerned, this final judgment, well, it isn't really a final judgment. It's a tentative judgment until we get back to him with all these reports. But as far as we're concerned, he conceded that we were not unconstitutional in terms of overcrowding or programming. But he did set the caps. He did also say that the court should not be involved in the day-to-day operations of corrections. I suppose that's a statement that he's made because in many other states they have been involved in day-to-day operations. The court was very complimentary to superintendents and upper-level management who testified in court and the efforts they've made to bring changes about. Essentially, I see this decision as one that warns the Department of Corrections, the state of Alaska, actually, that the court wants to maintain a check on what we're doing, on our improvements. And clearly the main theme that emerges from all of this paper is the court says, in my opinion, that we're not in trouble now, but he sees us getting into trouble very soon, and he wants to know how we're going to stay out of trouble. And that's what our attorneys are discussing. If we're not in trouble, then does the court have the authority to make these orders? So we want to know from the legal people whether this is considered a legitimate order and whether the state should indeed appeal it. I think, just from my own perspective, many of the changes that were in the partial, I shouldn't say changes, many of the items that were in the partial settlement agreement signed 2 years ago, and in fact, many of the items that the court addresses here were already taken care of by various people in the department. The case, however, makes it a matter of case law, I suppose, and solidifies things, puts it all down at one point. But I share the court's concern with the continuing pressure from the increased inmate population, more people coming in, but I don't believe that I don't believe it's a concern of the court at this time. If we're not violating the constitutional or statutory standards at this time, then I think that maybe we have a good opportunity here to go back to court and appeal that.
A question. Now, I'm confused. I can remember, Senator Sturdzielewski, when you were chairing budget and audit, and we were looking at the proposed agreement then in this case, and there was a great deal of discussion, and that agreement was signed. Is that correct?
Yes.
That was above the objection of many of us.
Well, there are real concerns because of the specificity of what they were saying and the cost that it threw on the state senator was.
I guess my problem is with all this going on with Cleary for a number of years, and with the changes in the sentencing pattern, et cetera. You know, that 120 days for the study. Why hasn't there been some effort made on that previously, so that you're a little bit ahead of the curve on this?
That's a difficult one to answer. It's one that I've been asking, the same question I've been asking for 2 years since I've been in office. And we have now got Senate Judiciary and House Judiciary. They commenced with a first work session meeting on that very issue, and they had that part of the cabinet that has to do with the criminal justice system testify. And both chairmen agreed that they would continue having work sessions to go further with this very issue.
Well, do you have in the hoppers right now any proposed legislation to take care of some of these areas where they feel that the statutes, that your regulations are more stringent than the statutes? Have you made any recommendations to any of the lawmakers about trying to change that?
Yes, we have House Bill 114, which is a major rewrite of all the correctional statutes. They have been a kind of a hodgepodge of statutes since statehood, and of course with a new department, the time I think was right to rewrite this. It was introduced in the last session and went through two sessions, I should say, in the 13th legislature. It's been rewritten now and introduced into the 14th legislature, and House, Hess, and Judiciary have been holding joint hearings on it. It's
only on the House side?
Yes. There are three pieces of legislation that we've introduced, and there are 3 to 4 pieces of legislation that various legislators have introduced having to do with restitution centers, that sort of thing.
Well, it's not the ones that legislators have introduced that I was asking about. It's what's come out of your department.
Yeah, we have 3 major bills. One has to do with time accounting, which on its face sounds boring, but in essence that would save us some bed space. Not a lot, but it would help. And it would give us 1 time accounting system rather than 3, which we now have to do. Another is a rewrite of the parole legislation. And the third major one is what we call the omnibus bill, but it's House Bill 114, which is a rewrite of all the correctional statutes.
You only have it on one side of the body.
Yes.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
A few questions, if I could.
Absolutely.
Seems like this legislation that came out, and possibly the earlier legislation, is kind of interesting. It speaks to what the state should be doing to house its prisoners. And then it goes down into very specific kinds of operational issues. And I guess my question for you, there are several questions, but one question is, those are the kinds of things that a department should be doing. You should know or be able to tell the legislature what you need. And then there's always the sharing of blame if we're not able to do it. You have to operate, you're not given the resources, and so on, but at least you have something to go with. Certainly the operational thing comes under the headings of the, again, the department and its responsibility.
this goes back, and I'm not going to lay it all on you, but when do we reach that point so that we catch up, that we can respond to that? I mean, it's very bothersome that the court has to tell us to plan when that's just a very basic part of a management responsibility. And for the court to come in and set standards for your analysis and for this and for that, I just find shocking, in a sense, there's an abrogation of where the responsibility should be. So how do we get, if we're out totally out of sync, how do we get into sync?
Well, first of all, Senator Strzelewski, we're not out of sync. We're ahead of the eight ball. We are having trouble keeping up with the inmate increase. That's something out of control. But we have added almost 800 beds in 24 months to our correctional system. The legislature has authorized almost 400 new employees in two sessions. We've increased our programming, our medical. We've done all of these things. We've got annual reports, and we've done all of that from management. Now, the court, in my opinion, is coming back telling us we must continue to do the same thing. The court is saying that what you're doing is okay. I just want to be assured that you're going to stay out of trouble. Now, I agree with you. I'm offended, too, mm-hmm. that the court is putting this down in language of the court. But I'm afraid, in my experience, that once these issues enter the legal process, whether we like it or not, the attorneys for both sides have to argue things out and hammer them out, and the judge agrees or disagrees and so on and issues an opinion. That's the process involved in the courts. But the executive and legislative branch, in my opinion, again, over the last 25, 26 months, have worked very closely together on correctional issues and put in substantial resources. So I don't think it's an abrogation of responsibility. I think the court is stepping in to the executive branch of government and saying, do this, this, and this. And we're about to say, we don't think you have that right, since we weren't found unconstitutional. I can't say that flatly because we don't have the attorney's review yet.
All right, Madam Chair. In the event that you went for a further appeal, what happens then? Is there a stay to the conditions, or are you saying to us that you've really met all those conditions and they're merely putting them down in the piece of paper to say, if there's another challenge, here we told you to do this and you're not keeping up? Is that your interpretation, that you're really doing all right, but that they exercise their ability to lay down these certain parameters more as a check in the case of future trouble? Is that what you're saying?
That's my understanding.
All right, if you were to appeal the case because you feel that they went too far in terms of body searches or some of the specifics, are there things that, say, have a money impact that you would also be challenging, or is it that they were interfering, you feel, with that operational part of what you do?
We feel that this is preliminary, but mm-hmm. but it looks to us like the court has stepped into our affairs when there was no legitimate right to do so. The court would have an issue before it, and he would find black or white on that issue. Instead, this court apparently found gray. Mm-hmm. And we're saying, sorry, we don't think that's right. And unless you can show where the state is at fault here, based on the record in the trial, then it may be that we want to argue that you don't have that authority.
Could that agreement previously signed have anything to do with some of this?
Let me just say that if this is appealed, I want the whole thing appealed, including the partial settlement agreement.
Well, that didn't answer my question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
My question was, could the partial settlement agreement have had something to do with this?
Oh,
aren't
yes.
Are there things in it that this is touching on it? I see some on just about every page.
Yes. Yes, there is. That's another part of the potential appeal process. Let me get back to that in a second. You also mentioned, Senator Strzelewski, about a stay. Apparently, a stay may be very difficult to mm-hmm. come by. First, we would have to go to the sentencing judge or the judge in our case. It may be unlikely that he'd be willing to grant a stay pending appeal. Mm-hmm. So the next level of appeal is to the Supreme Court. They would probably only grant a stay, I'm not a legal expert, but probably only grant a stay if there were a major constitutional issue at stake, and there probably isn't here. So a stay is unlikely, which means I'd have to comply with the order pending the outcome of an appeal, which may be a couple of years down the road. I'm sorry.
Excuse me, I thought you just said that there could very well be a constitutional issue. If they are getting into their three branches of government, isn't it a constitutional issue when you get into one of the other's functions?
Yes, but here I'm getting beyond my level of expertise. It seems that the attorneys are saying that there's no immediate constitutional issue which would cause the Supreme Court to stay the order. In other words, we'd go ahead and carry out the order until they got the appeal out of the way, which may be a couple of years down the road. But again, there's if I had to swallow this decision, as is, no appeal and so on, there isn't anything in here we can't live with because we're already doing this. Now, there's a couple of things, search and seizure and so on, we might take issue with, but it's not a major item. It hurts our operations, but, you know, we can live with it. The issue really is, I think, what are the parameters for the court as opposed to the executive and legislative branches of government. Now, if he had found that we were seriously unconstitutionally overcrowded, he would have come back and laid on both of us, I'm sure. But he didn't do that.
On page 5, number 5, under training, where they're asking you for regulation policy statements regarding procedures, mentioned that the trial for retention of correction of officers who have been disciplined or suspended. Will we see any of this material?
Certainly. Anything that we would develop is open to anyone, everyone. I think what this is about is evidently someone testified during trial that, I know what happened, is that the attorney for the plaintiffs evidently argued that we need to send these people back through a retraining process. That's certainly possible. It's not difficult. Send them back through the academy or some specialized training.
But it is expensive.
Well, we have training going on anyway, so it's not difficult to add another body or two.
Commissioner, you've a couple of things that the court said, the setting of the population caps and then a study of the impact of presumptive sentencing. I'm assuming that they're getting at that because of its impact on the population, the inmate population. Is that correct? They ask you how you intend to meet the increased population projection. Then they go on into the various kinds of things, non-residential space. How are you handling that kind of planning? You talk about the increase in beds that you've done. Have you taken steps to do that, or are you, where are you, and how are you doing that?
Yes, we've increased something like 120% the number of beds in halfway houses in the last 2 years. We have about 200 halfway house beds online now. Well, tying one of your earlier questions together with this one, what we're trying to do is adjust both ends of the correctional spectrum. We're trying to take care of misdemeanants and perhaps this restitution center concept. Low-risk offenders can go to halfway houses, restitution centers, and centers to hold misdemeanants at much lower cost than housing those same people in our regular institutions. So if we can take care of that low-risk end of this correctional spectrum at lower cost, that's going to save money and free up beds, at least temporarily. On the other end of the spectrum is the need for long-term, high-security space for the huge number of felons that we have. Some of these people serve in very long periods of time. If we can adjust, take care of the needs on both ends of that correctional spectrum, I can solve the problem with the rest of the people who are in the middle. That is medium-security space, pretrial space, those kinds of things. But I have to have help on both ends. Now, obviously, our plans for Seward, or I don't care what other plan, but some high security plan of some sort has to be brought online very soon. The partial settlement agreement on the federal prisoners, which was concluded before I even came into office, said that by 1987, those prisoners outside had to be offered the opportunity to come back. But it was dependent upon funding by the legislature for the space. Clearly, we're getting to the point now where, regardless of the people in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, I have to have more space, even if you forget them.
How do you see your relationship, both you're an administrator and the executive? You have the legislature faced with its money situations. You become, in a sense, the victim when you have to provide housing for the people that we've mandated are going to go to jail.
Right.
All right, so you've got that kind of a circle. How do you break that or stop and say, okay, these are our problems, we need to make changes in that because the system is broken down or it's overloaded and so on? Do you have ongoing discussions with the court system, say in the area of presumptive sentencing and other ways? Are you preparing information? We don't sit on the Judiciary Committee for other committees that change the system of justice. Is there a mechanism, for instance, in your dealing with health and social services to say, okay, departments, you've got to put more money into prevention programs because we're choking over here? How does the system turn around and get better? Because here we have a case where over the past few years, the court has stepped in, and in many ways, they're mandating how we're going to run our system. And I don't have any confidence sitting here, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't have any confidence that that situation is going to get any better, other than if we just don't attract people, so therefore we don't have people going into jail.
The basic step taken by the governor was to form a criminal justice work group, much like the former Governor's Commission on the Administration of Justice. And we meet monthly, and it does include the commissioners and chiefs of police, the court is represented, and so on, and we discuss all of these kinds of things, these major policy directions. But, you know, let me put on my criminologist hat for just a minute from the university instead of commissioner's hat. I'm often asked, what causes crime? I mean, all these people are committing crime and so on. Why are they coming into the system now in higher numbers than ever before? I noticed that a newspaper article a couple of weeks ago showed Alaska. There's an article, the headline said something like Alaska's population has increased by 19%. And right under it was an article about the prison system where the prison population has increased 22%. Mm-hmm. We rank number 7 in the nation for our incarceration rate per 100,000. We're very high. If you want to know, I mean, I'm exaggerating for a moment to make a point. If you want to know what causes crime, the law causes crime, because it's the law that describes certain behaviors as illegal. Mm-hmm. And then we put sanctions on those violations, numbers of years, mandatory sentences, and so on. So we not only have 300 more prisoners coming into the system each year than we're releasing, but those who are coming in are staying much longer periods of time than ever before. So it's not just the number coming in, it's the number who are not getting released. In just a very short period of time, only half of our population will be eligible for parole because presumptive sentences has eliminated everybody else. I get teased all the time by the staff for using the bathtub analogy, but it's simply you either adjust the flow coming into the system or the flow going out, or you build a bigger bathtub.
How did you testify on the mandatory sentences bills and on those that were going to raise the number of people you had to deal with in your department?
Well, those bills were worked on in 78, 79, and the criminal code went into effect in 1980. And then we began seeing the real climb began in 1981. There obviously is a lag time. I didn't bring over my graph today, but I can show you one. It's in our annual report. It just goes right off the chart. If it were a profit line, we'd be in great shape, but it's not. Our budget has jumped. When I walked in the door, it was $37 million. This year, it's $76 million, and that's with a $2.2 million cut that the legislature's asked us to make. What I'm trying to do is find, and this is not easy, but I'm trying to find the least costly way of resolving the overcrowding situation. Now, that gets very tricky, and it means that I have to coordinate with 60 legislators and the governor's office and a lot of other commissioners in order to get that accomplished. We have, in fact, brought Wildwood online, which is a former military site, Goose Bay, former military site. We've rehabilitated the bulk of that work was done by inmate labor, saving the state many millions of dollars. We did bring the Bethel facility online from start to finish in 18 months. That was contracted out. The Nome facility will open next September. A year after that, the Mat-Su pretrial jail will open up. And hopefully the year after that, we'll have major new bed space for the long-term felons. But that beyond that, I have no other plans. So if we don't skim off the low-risk offenders, I have a real problem.
Well, I don't think you answered my question.
I'll try again.
My question was, what was the testimony of the department? How did you testify? Did you support the mandatory sentencing legislation that came through, or did you
Well, in 1978, I was at the university. I don't know.
Then you have no record in the departments of whatever. All this wasn't in 78.
That new criminal code was...
This is 85. I've been here quite a while.
The new criminal code went into effect in 1980, and it was passed a year earlier. They gave it a year lag time, so it was 78, 79.
There have been changes since, right?
Minor ones. There's new and harsher drug penalties and sex offender statutes. Mm-hmm. Those are new.
And drinking.
Drunk driving, yes.
And a few others, right?
Yeah, the only one I've had a chance to testify on has been drunk driving. And lost.
Then am I to presume that you testified against it?
Yes. What we testified against was even harsher punishments.
Long way around, but I got there after a
while. I'm sorry.
Are there further questions from...
I'd like to ask just a couple. Under the health care, it says administering of the medications limited to medical personnel. Do you have medical personnel on each shift?
Yes. Yes, we have typically a physician's assistant, and two, three, four, up to five nurses to cover the shifts around the clock. But we also have a combination of state employees and contractual medical personnel. Some institutions, for example, are more contractual than they are state employees. We go with wherever we can get the lowest cost.
Do you still have a copy, Commissioner, of the agreement that was signed a couple, 3 years ago?
We have in the office, yes.
Maybe that would help you. Could you see that we get a copy
sure
of that
can.
To reproduce for the members of the committee? Senator, did you?
If I might, Madam Chairman, on the partial settlement agreement, there's been a great deal of misunderstanding. That agreement was signed 11 days after I took office. But what's in the agreement is what causes the misunderstanding. Our estimate of costs related to that agreement was, as I recall, about $300,000 to $350,000, which was submitted to the legislature as a package two sessions back, the same time I took office. So there was not a huge amount of money related to the Clery Partial Settlement Agreement. As a matter of fact, many of the items in that agreement were already in our policies and procedure manuals. The court, again, made an official record out of it. So there's a great deal of misunderstanding, I think, about that. The real costs have to do with substantial numbers of new employees and creation of new bed space. But on the programming side, the costs have not been substantial.
Well, I just feel, Commissioner, it'd be an eye-opener for those who haven't read it.
Yes.
Because I think it's important that they understand what some of the agreements are.
Yes.
Is there anything else you'd like to bring before us today?
I guess maybe I'm worried more again about misunderstandings. The state of Alaska today has a better correctional system than it did 2 years ago. It's substantially better. Morale is up. The professionalism has increased. I guess I've had two sort of theme songs that I share with the staff every time I get a chance to talk to them. One is professionalism, the other one is putting inmates to work. And we're doing both. We're increasing the professionalism, and we have more inmates at work in this system than ever before. You have more beds than you've ever had before. Adding 800 beds in 24 months is phenomenal for a state this size. So we've done it at relatively low cost in a very short amount of time. And I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the legislature and the executive branch should be patted on the back because we've accomplished, we've stayed out of trouble. We'd have been in trouble a long time ago, and a court would have found much differently than he did here if we hadn't been working so hard. So I think we've got a good system. It's one you can have confidence in. There will be a need for some more changes, but I don't think they're terribly costly with one exception, and that's bringing on the high end of the scale bed space. That is expensive. But we've already got some capital money that you gave us last year. And we need to touch that up and make it final, and then we're ready to start construction this spring. So the commitments have been made, and I think we're in good shape. We're just arguing with the court whether he has authority to tell us to do all these things or not. We'll be deciding in the next few days what to tell the court. It's been suggested that maybe the court would like to come to work for corrections, but he might not be qualified.
Madam Chair, I guess that the one thing, and this is... perhaps a bit beyond the discussion today, but I don't think we've answered the hard question about how you change from a punitive system to a preventive system. You take out at the other end, I mean, your work programs, early release, different handling of miscreants, and so on. You relieve some of the pressures of that bed space. Now, if that's also rehabilitative, that perhaps is part of the problem. You don't catch them at the end so they get into the system, but you help them here. And I think that kind of thing maybe has to be the next
effort, because there simply will not be the resources, perhaps, to do what we've done or you feel has been done in the last 2 years. You simply are not going to be able to carry forward at that level. And I don't know if you have any ideas there again, because we tend to separate things into boxes in terms of responsibility, although in this case the court came in and took some responsibility basically from the state saying you have to do these things because we don't feel you're doing it.
I think, again, just a short response, I think that from my perspective there are two major problems in the state. One is the high levels of abuse of alcohol. It's related to 85% of the offenders that we have incarcerated. And the other major problem I see is one that I think you have to get back to the family and teach kids how to be parents, and I think you teach morality and all those things. Now, that's pretty difficult to legislate, but unless we get a return to the family unit and have people start behaving in a moral sense, whatever that may mean, we won't see much reduction in crime. Alaska has all the chemistry it needs for a high crime rate. We've got a very youthful population, high seasonal unemployment, highest per capita income. At the same time, you have the high seasonal unemployment, and we have one of the highest alcohol abuse rates in the nation. So you put that all together, and you get a high crime rate. Not only that, it's a high violent crime rate. Our profile of our prisoners has changed dramatically in 10 years. It used to be predominantly property offenders. Now they're predominantly assaultive, crimes against persons. So we've got a very different profile than we had before. The actual numbers have gone up dramatically. We've doubled our population in roughly 2.5 years. We're now over 2,100 prisoners.
How many of those property offenders are assaulted offenders?
Not many. I mean, by the very nature of the crime, burglary, theft kinds of crimes do not necessarily involve assault, although...
If the person happens to be there, they do.
Yes, well...
I was reminded of that by a report I just finished reading. So evidently we're different from a lot of the other areas of the state if it's not highly related.
Well, many of the... There's a trend nationally towards more violent behavior. I don't want to over-exaggerate it, but there is that change, that shift. There's more robbery, more rape, more murder, more assaultive kinds of crimes than there used to be a decade ago.
Thinking twice before they commit a crime.
It's interesting that Senator Sackett asked me that just a couple of weeks ago. He said, if the drunk driving statutes are a deterrent, his question to me, are there fewer people coming in for drunk driving now than there were before? And the answer is absolutely not. There's even more. So the argument that drunk driving statutes are a deterrent is facetious. It does not deter. The problem is it deters you and I, probably, who aren't going to break the law anyway. But the guy who goes out and drinks and drives, it may deter some of them, but they're coming in greater numbers than they ever have. And if it's a deterrence, why is that happening? So the criminologist could have told folks that a long time ago, but...
We were looking for that kind of testimony, but we got just the other in most of the hearings that we had.
Well, I think, Madam Chairman, it's difficult for legislators, too. I mean, you represent your constituents, and it's easy to get tough on crime and criminals. You can go home, I could go home, tell my constituents, if I were a legislator, that we're going to lock these people up for 10 days, 15 days, 30 days, whatever. That sounds great, it sounds tough, but then I'm the one who gives the bill to you. I say, for those 15 days, here's the bill, times the number of people that are coming to jail. And that's when it gets up into the millions. And the constituents back home don't understand if you begin, in quote, softening up some of those statutes. So what we have to do is try to look for reasonable ways to adjust to this problem that are not costly and still will protect the public. And we think we've got some answers in contracting bed space out to the private sector. We think we can do it for a half or a third or something of cost. That'll help. But
is
in the long...
Is that halfway house at Fairbanks still working well?
Yes, it seems to be. We could probably increase the capacity there, but some of these statutes that we have in are going to help us. So I think...
I can't miss an opportunity. You said morale was high. It's not too high right now in my area, is it?
Yes, ma'am, it is. I hope you're probably only hearing from a small number of constituents, and I think if you had the chance to talk to some of the rest of the employees up there, you'd get a very different picture. I've been following that very closely, and it seems to me that the morale in both the institution and the Fairbanks Regional Probation Office has gone up tremendously. And I would invite you, I now have approval to come to our office, and I'd be glad to share some of the background material with you.
I need to have that shared because the pressures have not let up in any way, shape, form, or fashion.
Well, I can understand.
And not just what are referred to as my friends. Are there further questions? Or? Senator, you have the courtesy of the committee. Do you have any that you'd like to ask? Then, Commissioner Indell, we thank you very much for your bringing us this to our attention. And would you please see that I have a copy of that agreement to share with the committee? I looked for it before I came up, so I wouldn't have to ask you for it. But in these offices, 3 or 4 years, sometimes bulky material has a way of disappearing or getting over to the library or something.
Would you like a copy for each member or just
I
one?
I can make a copy. Okay. It's whatever's convenient.
Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you very much, Commissioner. Minister, his committee back. Did you have a chance, Paul, to read that letter more closely?
Yeah. You could hold it there.
Well, I'd like to know what your current concern is. Do you want to see yours moved up closer? Is that what you're saying?
I think, first of all, there's an error that you probably should have corrected to start it off.
Which one is that?
Where it talks about the Kenai, it says zero. Active $3.2 million project, and we're asking the state for 1.7 of that. Whereas, if you look at the beginning, it shows $0.
Which page, please?
Page 2.
Number 7?
Yeah. Where the zero is, that probably the 1.7 should shift over there. Then in parentheses, it probably should be 3.2 million, which makes a difference.
Where is Edie? Can you tell me how that came to be that way? I thought it was said that they.
Oh, Dennis
Dimitis
here. That's from Hospital Association.
Dennis, can you tell us anything about that? Number 7.
I see it. I think I know what the answer is, but if I can see the document.
I know what the answer is. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, what it needs is the total amount of the project, I think, and that is being met by bonding. I think there needs to be some reference to the fact that the local taxpayers are, in this case, paying for so much. I can understand where Senator Fisher's coming from.
I think the intent of that one, and I do believe that's a typo, we were trying to answer 3 questions. On that one, we answered 2 on the rest. The question was, how much was the request? What's the minimum to do something? And the third question in there was the difference between what they needed and the minimum. Mm-hmm. Mr. Lockwood's testimony was that with or without state help, the project would proceed.
Yes.
And it was in that context that the zero got in there. But I think that what we were trying to do, and it probably should be the 1.736, I think, is the number that Mike gave us.
Take
and the 3 point. Yeah, it should be the 3.2. But that was the reason for the 3 of them.
Madam Chair, on that, I do think there, I really do, in fairness, that is the one place within the state that has a hospital service district, and they're paying, I believe it is, and they are paying for their construction. I think there ought to be some note there, because their pitch was.
How would you like it worded?
Just say that.
This is one area.
There's local participation.
The operation of the hospital tax dollars, too. This is the thing that a lot of people don't see.
Shall we say the operation and building this hospital is
due? Madam Chair, I think if we could just say non-prioritized at the top, I'd be happy with it. I don't care where it fits in. In other words,
but I still think it ought to be noted that that local area is carrying a lot of the expense.
I do, too.
Yeah.
With that, I'm delighted with the letter.
You see what I'm saying, Paul? I think that should say that the local area is a hospital area and are taxing themselves.
Yeah, I think
that's
it's
true,
important.
That's not true to any of the rest of us.
And
that's right.
Have provided X amount, whatever that dollar figure of this addition.
Yeah. Could you help me with
sure.
that?
Sure, be happy to. The
then would that change, would this letter satisfy the group?
Madam Chair, I'm probably going to be the only one who won't. I think, and let me tell you where I'm coming from, if you just have 3 minutes. I'm looking at it from a historical point of view, and I think the image gets out there somewhere that the Kenai Peninsula always had a lot of money.
And maybe we do have a good tax base, but if you look at hospitals, for example, local taxes traditionally have always paid. We've never had state grants before. You get into schools, local taxes again. We don't get state grants like Anchorage, not to pick on Anchorage, but we never had any ability to come down here and say, this school will be totally funded by the state. It's always a bond proposition. You get into roads. Okay, we take our municipal assistance money and put it in state roads. And these things, you never get credit for. Whereas other areas, when they take municipal assistance and money like that, it goes into other programs. We fix up state roads that the state should be doing. And so when you come down to a project like this, you say, my God, you know, somehow the Kenai Peninsula ought to be able to get a little bit of help from the state to alleviate the local taxpayers. And I know this isn't any big amount, but I guess I have a hard time when I look, and I don't mean to pick on anybody, but Kodiak has a taxing ability that's the same as the Kenai. So does Juneau, so does Nome, so does, you know. And yet it seems like the Kenai has always said, well, no, you guys got to go tax. And I guess from an equity point of view is my big objection. It just seems like somewhere we got to get some credit on the Kenai Peninsula for our local tax effort across the board, which I think we're, you know...
Are your Kenai taxes to the home higher than they are in Juneau?
Well, the mill rate probably not, because we don't have other services. But what I'm saying for the services we offer, see, we're a second-class borough.
But
we have a sales tax for schools, which other areas don't have. You know, these are things that people don't see, and our sales tax is pretty hefty. I think it's 3 mils, or 3%, I think, for 2 or 3, but that goes for schools, and that's beyond the real estate taxes. But, you know, you can look at the Kenai, and every issue coming up, they say, well, the total tax mill rate is here, so therefore you pay through the nose. I would like to see the legislature make some kind of a provision that we could have a permanent fund. You know, where we could tax, say, 10 mils and put the rest of it in an account for our own people. But like in this hospital, almost half of those people are not going to be from that service area. They're going to be coming down for detox from Fairbanks, Anchorage, because maybe they don't want to stay in their hometown. And we're, the local taxpayers, are going to have to pay for a detox center for people that aren't even from our service area, because we can't.
Well, do any of your people come to some other area for detox?
But we pay. What I'm saying, Madam Chair, this hospital is a taxing. On the tax roll.
That's why I think that should be in there.
That's why I think we're getting more. So, you know, if it wouldn't be that prioritization, I don't have any objection to the first two schools. You know, I go along, or the first four hospitals. But when you get into the other area, we're the only one out of the back that is really shovel ready. We're the only one, I believe, has a certificate of need granted.
Madam Chair,
and that's right.
No, there's others that have a certificate of need granted.
In the second batch?
Madam Chair, I wonder a point. On the letter that was done, they showed the first four projects as priority.
Right.
The rest were in this, pardon the expression, amorphous mass. No, there was no priority rating. There is a possibility that you could, in fact, do that, you could show the first four, and then you could show it like the Hospital Association did, and have their attachment
projects,
that
but not
gave them, and with the information, but not put 6, 7, 8, or whatever it is.
No, I go with that. You know, okay. Right. Because
but
no
you still, then you are not doing, you could still have the same information, add to Kenai the fact that it is a hospital district, and they're providing X amount from their own effort, and then have them together. And I
between
think
4 and 5 ago, these are where the projects, but not in the prioritization list.
Well, it's the same as the hospital group did. That's what you did, right?
And then add down there that your area
that would be very
is a hospital area plan.
Don't see Anchorage is kind and problem-solving oriented.
And particularly their senator.
Even they do get grants for their schools, right?
Yeah,
right. Okay. Don't change. I've got the constituents out there. Yeah. Sure. Super. You got it. Good job.
Now we are.
Thank you very much, Matt.